It happened, while he was yet only beginning his vast work of awakening the nation, that an impudent fellow named Tetzel, a friar of very bad character, came into his neighborhood selling what were called indulgences, by wholesale, to raise money for beautifying the great cathedral of St. Peter at EMS, at Rome. Whoever bought an indulgence of the Pope was supposed to buy himself off from the punishment of heaven for his offenses. Luther told the people that these indulgences were worthless bits of paper, before God, and that Tetzel and his masters were a crew of impostors in selling them. The king and the cardinal were mightily indignant at this presumption, and the king, with the help of Sir Thomas More, a wise man, whom he afterwards repaid by striking off his head, even wrote a book about it, with which the Pope was so well pleased that he gave the king the title of Defender of the Faith. The king and the cardinal also issued flaming warnings to the people not to read Luther at EMS books, on pain of excommunication. But they did read them for all that, and the rumor of what was in them spread far and wide. When this great change was thus going on, the king began to show himself in his truest and worst colors. Anne Boleyn, the pretty little girl who had gone abroad to France with his sister, was by this time grown up to be very beautiful, and was one of the ladies in attendance on Queen Catherine. Now, Queen Catherine was no longer young or handsome, and it is likely that she was not particularly good-tempered, having been always rather melancholy, and having been made more so by the deaths of four of her children when they were very young. So, the king fell in love with the fair Anne Boleyn, and said to himself, "Eh, how can I be best rid of my own troublesome wife whom I am tired of, and marry Anne?" ATM, you recollect that Queen Catherine had been the wife of Henry at EMS brother. What does the king do, after thinking it over, but calls his favorite priests about him, and says, "Oh, his mind is in such a dreadful state, and he is so frightfully uneasy, because he is afraid it was not lawful for him to marry the queen." Not one of those priests had the courage to hint that it was rather curious he had never thought of that before, and that his mind seems to have been in a tolerably jolly condition during a great many years, in which he certainly had not fretted himself thin, but, they all said, "Ah, that was very true, and it was a serious business, and perhaps the best way to make it right, would be for His Majesty to be divorced." The king replied, yes, he thought that would be the best way, certainly, so they all went to work. If I were to relate to you the intrigues and plots that took place in the endeavor to get this divorce, you would think the history of England the most tiresome book in the world. So I shall say no more than that after a vast deal of negotiation and evasion, the Pope issued a commission to Cardinal Wolsey and Cardinal Campeggio, whom he sent over from Italy for the purpose, to try the whole case in England. It is supposed, and I think with reason, that Wolsey was the Queen at EMS enemy, because she had reproved him for his proud and gorgeous manner of life. But, he did not at first know that the king wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, and when he did know it, he even went down on his knees, in the endeavor to dissuade him. The cardinals opened their court in the convent of the Black Friars, near to where the bridge of that name in London now stands, and the king and queen, that they might be near it, took up their lodgings at the adjoining palace of Bridewell, of which nothing now remains but a bad prison. On the opening of the court, when the king and queen were called on to appear, that poor ill-used lady, with a dignity and firmness and yet with a womanly affection worthy to be always admired, went and kneeled at the king at EMS feet, and said that she had come, a stranger, to his dominions, that she had been a good and true wife to him for 20 years, and that she could acknowledge no power in those cardinals to try whether she should be considered his wife after all that time, or should be put away. With that, she got up and left the court, and would never afterwards come back to it. The king pretended to be very much overcome, and said, "Oh, my lords and gentlemen, what a good woman she was to be sure, and how delighted he would be to live with her unto death, but for that terrible uneasiness in his mind which was quite wearing him away." So, the case went on, and there was nothing but talk for 2 months. Then Cardinal Campeggio, who, on behalf of the Pope, wanted nothing so much as delay, adjourned it for 2 more months, and before the time was elapsed, the Pope himself adjourned it indefinitely, by requiring the king and queen to come to Rome and have it tried there. But by good luck for the king, word was brought to him by some of his people, that they had happened to meet at supper, Thomas Cranmer, a learned doctor of Cambridge, who had proposed to urge the Pope on, by referring the case to all the learned doctors and bishops, here and there and everywhere, and getting their opinions that the King of TMS marriage was unlawful. The king, who was now in a hurry to marry Anne Boleyn, thought this such a good idea, that he sent for Cranmer, post haste, and said to Lord Rochford, "Anne Boleyn a TMS father, take this learned doctor down to your country house, and there let him have a good room for a study, and no end of books out of which to prove that I may marry your daughter." A.T.M. Lord Rochford, not at all reluctant, made the learned doctor as comfortable as he could, and the learned doctor went to work to prove his case. All this time, the king and Anne Boleyn were writing letters to one another almost daily, full of impatience to have the case settled, and Anne Boleyn was showing herself, as I think, very worthy of the fate which afterwards befell her. It was bad for Cardinal Wolsey that he had left Cranmer to render this help. It was worse for him that he had tried to dissuade the king from marrying Anne Boleyn. Such a servant as he, to such a master as Henry, would probably have fallen in any case, but, between the hatred of the party of the queen that was, and the hatred of the party of the queen that was to be, he fell suddenly and heavily. Going down one day to the Court of Chancery, where he now presided, he was waited upon by the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk, who told him that they brought an order to him to resign that office, and to withdraw quietly to a house he had at Esher, in Surrey. The Cardinal refusing, they rode off to the king, and next day came back with a letter from him, on reading which, the Cardinal submitted. An inventory was made out of all the riches in his palace at York Place, now Whitehall, and he went sorrowfully up the river, in his barge, to Putney. An abject man he was, in spite of his pride, for being overtaken, riding out of that place towards Esher, by one of the King of TMS chamberlains who brought him a kind message and a ring, he alighted from his mule, took off his cap, and kneeled down in the dirt. His poor fool, whom in his prosperous days he had always kept in his palace to entertain him, cut a far better figure than he, for, when the Cardinal said to the chamberlain that he had nothing to send to his lord the king as a present, but the jester who was a most excellent one, it took six strong yeomen to remove the faithful fool from his master. The once proud Cardinal was soon further disgraced, and wrote the most abject letters to his vile sovereign, who humbled him one day and encouraged him the next, according to his humour, until he was at last ordered to go and reside in his diocese of York. He said he was too poor, but I don't yet know how he made that out, for he took 160 servants with him, and 72 cartloads of furniture, food, and wine. He remained in that part of the country for the best part of a year, and showed himself so improved by his misfortunes, and was so mild and so conciliating, that he won all hearts. And indeed, even in his proud days, he had done some magnificent things for learning and education. At last, he was arrested for high treason, and, coming slowly on his journey towards London, got as far as Leicester. Arriving at Leicester Abbey after dark, and very ill, he said when the monks came out at the gate with lighted torches to receive him that he had come to lay his bones among them. He had indeed, for he was taken to a bed, from which he never rose again. His last words were, "Had I but served God as diligently as I have served the king, he would not have given me over, in my grey hairs. Howbeit, this is my just reward for my pains and diligence, not regarding my service to God, but only my duty to my prince." A.T.M. The news of his death was quickly carried to the king, who was amusing himself with archery in the garden of the magnificent palace at Hampton Court, which that very Wolsey had presented to him. The greatest emotion his royal mind displayed at the loss of a servant so faithful and so ruined, was a particular desire to lay hold of £1,500 which the Cardinal was reported to have hidden somewhere. The opinions concerning the divorce, of the learned doctors and bishops and others, being at last collected, and being generally in the King of TMS' favour, were forwarded to the Pope, with an entreaty that he would now grant it. The unfortunate Pope, who was a timid man, was half distracted between his fear of his authority being set aside in England if he did not do as he was asked, and his dread of offending the Emperor of Germany, who was Queen Caterina Tiamat's nephew. In this state of mind he still evaded and did nothing. Then, Thomas Cromwell, who had been one of Wolsey Tiamat's faithful attendants, and had remained so even in his decline, advised the king to take the matter into his own hands, and make himself the head of the whole church. This, the king by various artful means, began to do, but he recompensed the clergy by allowing them to burn as many people as they pleased, for holding Luther at TMS opinions. You must understand that Sir Thomas More, the wise man who had helped the king with his book, had been made chancellor in Wolsey at TMS place. But, as he was truly attached to the church as it was even in its abuses, he, in this state of things, resigned, being now quite resolved to get rid of Queen Catherine, and to marry Anne Boleyn without more ado. The king made Cranmer Archbishop of Canterbury, and directed Queen Catherine to leave the court. She obeyed, but replied that wherever she went, she was Queen of England still, and would remain so, to the last. The king then married Anne Boleyn privately, and the new Archbishop of Canterbury, within half a year, declared his marriage with Queen Catherine void, and crowned Anne Boleyn queen. She might have known that no good could ever come from such wrong, and that the corpulent brute who had been so faithless and so cruel to his first wife, could be more faithless and more cruel to his second. She might have known that, even when he was in love with her, he had been a mean and selfish coward, running away, like a frightened cur, from her society and her house, when a dangerous sickness broke out in it, and when she might easily have taken it and died, as several of the household did. But, Anne Boleyn arrived at all this knowledge too late, and bought it at a dear price. Her bad marriage with a worse man came to its natural end. Its natural end was not, as we shall too soon see, a natural death for her. Chapter XVIII. England under Henry VIII. Part the Second. The Pope was thrown into a very angry state of mind when he heard of the King of Tiamat's marriage, and fumed exceedingly. Many of the English monks and friars, seeing that their order was in danger, did the same. Some even declaimed against the king in church before his face, and were not to be stopped until he himself roared out a silence. A.T.M. the king, not much the worse for this, took it pretty quietly, and was very glad when his queen gave birth to a daughter, who was christened Elizabeth, and declared Princess of Wales as her sister Mary had already been. One of the most atrocious features of this reign was that Henry VIII was always drumming between the reformed religion and the unreformed one, so that the more he quarrelled with the Pope, the more of his own subjects he roasted alive for not holding the Pope TMS opinions. Thus, an unfortunate student named John Frith, and a poor simple tailor named Andrew Hewitt who loved him very much, and said that whatever John Frith believed he believed, were burnt in Smithfield to show what a capital Christian the king was. But, these were speedily followed by two much greater victims, Sir Thomas More, and John Fisher, the Bishop of Rochester. The latter, who was a good and amiable old man, had committed no greater offence than believing in Elizabeth Bardone, called the Maid of Kent to another of those ridiculous women who pretended to be inspired, and to make all sorts of heavenly revelations, though they indeed uttered nothing but evil nonsense. For this offence, as it was pretended, but really for denying the king to be the supreme head of the church, he got into trouble, and was put in prison, but, even then, he might have been suffered to die naturally, short work having been made of executing the Kentish maid and her principal followers, but that the Pope, to spite the king, resolved to make him a cardinal. Upon that the king made a ferocious joke to the effect that the Pope might send Fisher a red heart, which is the way they make a cardinal, but he should have no head on which to wear it, and he was tried with all unfairness and injustice, and sentenced to death. He died like a noble and virtuous old man, and left a worthy name behind him. The king supposed, I dare say, that Sir Thomas More would be frightened by this example, but, as he was not to be easily terrified, and, thoroughly believing in the Pope, had made up his mind that the king was not the rightful head of the church. He positively refused to say that he was. For this crime he too was tried and sentenced, after having been in prison a whole year, when he was doomed to death, and came away from his trial with the edge of the executioner at Ems axe turned towards him, as was always done in those times when a state prisoner came to that hopeless passer. He bore it quite serenely, and gave his blessing to his son, who pressed through the crowd in Westminster Hall and kneeled down to receive it. But, when he got to the Tower Wharf on his way back to his prison, and his favourite daughter, Margaret Roper, a very good woman, rushed through the guards again and again, to kiss him and to weep upon his neck, he was overcome at last. He soon recovered, and never more showed any feeling but cheerfulness and courage. When he was going up the steps of the scaffold to his death, he said jokingly to the lieutenant of the Tower, observing that they were weak and shook beneath his tread, "I pray you, Master Lieutenant, see me safe up, and, for my coming down, I can shift for myself." "ATM also," he said to the executioner, after he had laid his head upon the block, "let me put my beard out of the way, for that, at least, has never committed any treason." "ATM then his head was struck off at a blow. These two executions were worthy of King Henry VIII. Sir Thomas More was one of the most virtuous men in his dominions, and the bishop was one of his oldest and truest friends. But to be a friend of that fellow was almost as dangerous as to be his wife. When the news of these two murders got to Rome, the Pope raged against the murderer more than ever Pope raged since the world began, and prepared a bull, ordering his subjects to take arms against him and dethrone him. The king took all possible precautions to keep the document out of his dominions, and set to work in return to suppress a great number of the English monasteries and abbeys. This destruction was begun by a body of commissioners, of whom Cromwell, whom the king had taken into great favour, was the head, and was carried on through some few years to its entire completion. There is no doubt that many of these religious establishments were religious in nothing but in name, and were crammed with lazy, indolent, and sensual monks. There is no doubt that they imposed upon the people in every possible way, that they had images moved by wires, which they pretended were miraculously moved by heaven, that they had among them a whole ton measure full of teeth, all purporting to have come out of the head of one saint, who must indeed have been a very extraordinary person with that enormous allowance of grinders, that they had bits of coal which they said had fried Saint Lawrence, and bits of toenails which they said belonged to other famous saints, penknives, and boots, and girdles, which they said belonged to others, and that all these bits of rubbish were called relics, and adored by the ignorant people. But, on the other hand, there is no doubt either, that the king of Ems officers and men punished the good monks with the bad, did great injustice, demolished many beautiful things and many valuable libraries, destroyed numbers of paintings, stained glass windows, fine pavements, and carvings, and that the whole court were ravenously greedy and rapacious for the division of this great spoil among them. The king seems to have grown almost mad in the ardour of this pursuit, for he declared Thomas A. Tilda Becket a traitor, though he had been dead so many years, and had his body dug up out of his grave. He must have been as miraculous as the monks pretended, if they had told the truth, for he was found with one head on his shoulders, and they had shown another as his undoubted and genuine head ever since his death. It had brought them vast sums of money, too. The gold and jewels on his shrine filled two great chests, and eight men tottered as they carried them away. How rich the monasteries were you may infer from the fact that, when they were all suppressed, £130,000 a year in those days an immense sum came to the crown. These things were not done without causing great discontent among the people. The monks had been good landlords and hospitable entertainers of all travellers, and had been accustomed to give away a great deal of corn, and fruit, and meat, and other things. In those days it was difficult to change goods into money, in consequence of the roads being very few and very bad, and the carts, and wagons of the worst description, And they must either have given away some of the good things they possessed in enormous quantities, or have suffered them to spoil and moulder. So, many of the people missed what it was more agreeable to get idly than to work for, and the monks who were driven out of their homes and wandered about encouraged their discontent, and there were, consequently, great risings in Lincolnshire and Yorkshire. These were put down by terrific executions, from which the monks themselves did not escape, and the king went on grunting and growling in his own fat way, like a royal pig. I have told all this story of the religious houses at one time, to make it plainer, and to get back to the king at EMS domestic affairs. The unfortunate Queen Catherine was by this time dead, and the king was by this time as tired of his second queen as he had been of his first. As he had fallen in love with her when she was in the service of Catherine, so he now fell in love with another lady in the service of Anne. See how wicked deeds are punished, and how bitterly and self-reproachfully the queen must now have thought of her own rise to the throne. The new fancy was a Lady Jane Seymour, and the king no sooner set his mind on her, than he resolved to have Anne Boleyn at EMS head. So, he brought a number of charges against Anne, accusing her of dreadful crimes which she had never committed, and implicating in them her own brother and certain gentlemen in her service, among whom one Norris, and Mark Smeaton a musician, are best remembered. As the lords and councillors were as afraid of the king and as subservient to him as the meanest peasant in England was, they brought in Anne Boleyn guilty, and the other unfortunate persons accused with her, guilty too. Those gentlemen died like men, with the exception of Smeaton, who had been tempted by the king into telling lies, which he called confessions, and who had expected to be pardoned, but who, I am very glad to say, was not. There was then only the queen to dispose of. She had been surrounded in the Tower with women spies, had been monstrously persecuted and foully slandered, and had received no justice. But her spirit rose with her afflictions, and, after having in vain tried to soften the king by writing an affecting letter to him which still exists, a from her doleful prison in the Tower, atm she resigned herself to death. She said to those about her, very cheerfully, that she had heard say the executioner was a good one, and that she had a little neck. She laughed and clasped it with her hands as she said that, and would soon be out of her pain. And she was soon out of her pain, poor creature, on the green inside the Tower, and her body was flung into an old box and put away in the ground under the chapel. There is a story that the king sat in his palace listening very anxiously for the sound of the cannon which was to announce this new murder, and that, when he heard it come booming on the air, he rose up in great spirits and ordered out his dogs to go a-hunting. He was bad enough to do it, but whether he did it or not, it is certain that he married Jane Seymour the very next day. I have not much pleasure in recording that she lived just long enough to give birth to a son who was christened Edward, and then to die of a fever, for, I cannot but think that any woman who married such a ruffian, and knew what innocent blood was on his hands, deserved the axe that would assuredly have fallen on the neck of Jane Seymour, if she had lived much longer. Cranmer had done what he could to save some of the church property for purposes of religion and education, but, the great families had been so hungry to get hold of it, that very little could be rescued for such objects. Even Miles Coverdale, who did the people the inestimable service of translating the Bible into English, which the unreformed religion never permitted to be done, was left in poverty while the great families clutched the church lands and money. The people had been told that when the crown came into possession of these funds, it would not be necessary to tax them, but they were taxed afresh directly afterwards. It was fortunate for them, indeed, that so many nobles were so greedy for this wealth, since, if it had remained with the crown, there might have been no end to tyranny for hundreds of years. One of the most active writers on the church at EMS side against the king was a member of his own family, a sort of distant cousin, Reginald Pole by name, who attacked him in the most violent manner, though he received a pension from him all the time, and fought for the church with his pen, day and night. As he was beyond the king at EMS reach of being in Italia, the king politely invited him over to discuss the subject, but he, knowing better than to come, and wisely staying where he was, the King of TMS Rage fell upon his brother Lord Montague, the Marquis of Exeter, and some other gentlemen, who were tried for high treason in corresponding with him and aiding him, which they probably did, and were all executed. The Pope made Reginald Pole a cardinal, but, so much against his will, that it is thought he even aspired in his own mind to the vacant throne of England, and had hopes of marrying the Princess Mary. His being made a high priest, however, put an end to all that. His mother, the venerable Countess of Salisbury, who was, unfortunately for herself, within the tyrant at TMS Reacher, was the last of his relatives on whom his wrath fell. When she was told to lay her grey head upon the block, she answered the executioner, "Ah no. My head never committed treason, and if you want it, you shall seize it." ATM So, she ran round and round the scaffold with the executioner striking at her, and her grey hair bedabbled with blood, and even when they held her down upon the block she moved her head about to the last, resolved to be no party to her own barbarous murder. All this the people bore, as they had borne everything else. Indeed they bore much more, for the slow fires of Smithfield were continually burning, and people were constantly being roasted to death still to show what a good Christian the king was. He defied the Pope and his bull, which was now issued, and had come into England, but he burned innumerable people whose only offence was that they differed from the Pope's TMS religious opinions. There was a wretched man named Lambert, among others, who was tried for this before the king, and with whom six bishops argued one after another. When he was quite exhausted, as well he might be, after six bishops, he threw himself on the King of TMS mercy, but the king blustered out that he had no mercy for heretics. So, he too fed the fire. All this the people bore, and more than all this yet. The national spirit seems to have been banished from the kingdom at this time. The very people who were executed for treason, the very wives and friends of the able TM king, spoke of him on the scaffold as a good prince, and a gentle princier, just as serfs in similar circumstances have been known to do, under the sultan and bashaws of the east, or under the fierce old tyrants of Russia, who poured boiling and freezing water on them alternately, until they died. The parliament were as bad as the rest, and gave the king whatever he wanted, among other vile accommodations. They gave him new powers of murdering, at his will and pleasure, anyone whom he might choose to call a traitor. But the worst measure they passed was an act of six articles, commonly called at the time the whip with six strings, ATM, which punished offences against the Pope TMS opinions, without mercy, and enforced the very worst parts of the monkish religion. Cranmer would have modified it, if he could, but, being overborne by the Romish party, had not the power. As one of the articles declared that priests should not marry, and as he was married himself, he sent his wife and children into Germany, and began to tremble at his danger, nonetheless because he was, and had long been, the King of TMS friend. This whip of six strings was made under the King of TMS own eye. It should never be forgotten of him how cruelly he supported the worst of the popish doctrines when there was nothing to be got by opposing them. This amiable monarch now thought of taking another wife. He proposed to the French king to have some of the ladies of the French court exhibited before him, that he might make his royal choice, but the French king answered that he would rather not have his ladies trotted out to be shown like horses at a fair. He proposed to the Dowager Duchess of Milan, who replied that she might have thought of such a match if she had had two heads, but, that only owning one, she must beg to keep it safe. At last Cromwell represented that there was a Protestant princess in Germany. Those who held the Reformed religion were called Protestants, because their leaders had protested against the abuses and impositions of the unreformed church. A named Anne of Cleves, who was beautiful, and would answer the purpose admirably. The king said, was she a large woman, because he must have a fat wife? Oh yes, ATM said Cromwell, she was very large. Just the thing. ATM On hearing this the king sent over his famous painter, Hans Holbein, to take her portrait. Hans made her out to be so good-looking that the king was satisfied, and the marriage was arranged. But, whether anybody had paid Hans to touch up the picture, or whether Hans, like one or two other painters, flattered a princess in the ordinary way of business, I cannot say. All I know is, that when Anne came over and the king went to Rochester to meet her, and first saw her without her seeing him, he swore she was a great Flanders mare, ATM, and said he would never marry her. Being obliged to do it now, matters had gone so far, he would not give her the presents he had prepared, and would never notice her. He never forgave Cromwell his part in the affair. His downfall dates from that time.